Welcome to Season 6 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
Terrace Be Damned, Allplay's Sail Legacy, is launching July 8th. It's a two-player cooperative trick-taking game with lots of cool legacy mechanics. Players are going to be customized, items will be destroyed, and the story will have branching paths on over 30 missions. Plus, after the campaign, you get to return any of the scenarios and replay them as if they were the original Sail maps. So for sure, check out this game. Super excited for it. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, Episode 118, Cuphead, Fast Rolling Dice Game. Today we are joined by Pat Marino, the Director of Hobby Games at The Op. Thanks, Pat, for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm excited to talk about this game because it was a hit video game, turn board game, and just seeing how people take that and move it into cardboard and cards is just interesting to me.
Yeah, it's a lot harder than I think most people realize because in the video game space, you've got a lot of tools that you can't use on tabletop, including training modules that teach you how the game works. You've got real-time elements that are much harder to recreate on a tabletop when you usually get into turn-based play and things like that. So that transition from instant setup, turn on your console and play the game, to now you've got to set up the pieces. You have to understand the rules and play correctly. The video game isn't going to keep you on the rails of how the system works. Takes quite a bit of doing to create a comparable experience in terms of the fun of the original video game, while also sort of celebrating what board games are and how they're different. It's a challenge we've faced many times at The Op.
Oh, I'm sure. And before we jump into that, I want you to say a little bit more about what you do at The Op and how you got into designing and developing games.
I'll start with how I got into designing games. I grew up playing games, played Magic, played some classic board games, things like that when I was a kid. Kind of fell out of it during college. And then after I finished grad school, I was working at Hamilton College, and a group of students that I worked with there asked me if I'd ever played Catan. And I said, no. And they said, well, you got to try it. We're obsessed. So they sat down with me, taught me to play. And probably within 2 weeks of my first play of Catan, I had designed my own game. Just didn't know the world of sort of Euro games and everything that existed beyond Catan. And since I played that, I wanted more. So I decided to just make it myself. That first game was pretty bad, as one might expect, but because I kind of fell in love with that process of creating games, I started doing a lot of research on like how to do it right, how to pitch games, how to get involved in the industry. I learned a lot more about the whole world that we now live in of board games, and started doing playtesting events, little unpubs locally, meeting with other designers and things. And with our like twice a year little mini unpub we used to run in San Diego, a lot of the local publishers came, and that included The Op. So they would come and scout games, and I got to know those folks, and ultimately was offered a job to design a single game on contract, which was Court of the Dead Mourner's Call. That very quickly turned into a full-time job. And then over the 8 or so years I've been at The Op, I've moved up from game designer to game design manager, and then into my current role as director of hobby games. And really my role now is crafting the line of products that we make in the hobby segment. That means meeting with inventors, playtesting, meeting with international partners, looking for games we might want to localize and distribute, and really just trying to find what are the best 3 to 5 strategy game products that fit our brand and identity that we want to put out in a given year. And then managing all that product development stuff to get them from wherever we find them to the finished goods that we put on shelf. So that's pretty much what I do.
I mean, I've known you now for years, and I've been one of those designers pitching and being rejected. No, just kidding. So you're director of hobby games. For people who don't know the difference between hobby and like, say, do you guys call it mass market, or what is the other title you use internally?
Yeah, so we have 3 product hubs internally at The Op. Hobby is what I do. And for us, it's like gateway light strategy games. We don't do the big, heavy 3-hour epics and things like that. It doesn't really fit our brand. There's a product hub that we call co-brand, and co-brand is an existing game mixed with a popular IP. So primarily that is our Hasbro partnership. So things like One Piece Monopoly, Naruto Clue, Grinch Operation, those kinds of products where we're putting an existing game together with something from the entertainment space. And then the third product hub is essentially mass market. We call it Party Family. And that's led by David Blanchard. And then Tony Cerbriani, who's our VP of Inventor Relations, is pretty involved in that scouting process as well. And they're really looking for lowest possible barrier to entry games that can succeed right off the bat at stores like Walmart and Target in the States, but also that can kind of go globally because they're just so accessible and easy to teach. Like most of those games, you never read the rule book because someone taught you to play it. And then you remembered every rule and you taught other people to play it and so on. So Flip 7 being sort of the perfect example right now from that hub. Games like Tapple, Telestrations, Hues and Cues, those kinds of things.
I'm a fan of all of the games that you guys have coming out. Just for my own personal question, I love the Rising system. Was that under the co-brand or was that under Hobby? Because I know it has like different IPs attached to it.
Yeah, it's a fair question. Rising actually happened before we had these product hubs. So we used to just have one line planning team that picked and figured out all the product, and it had representatives from essentially what are now all the different product hubs on it. And that game was an internal design that Andrew Wolf had created originally with kind of a generic high fantasy theme around it. And when we had an opportunity to do a licensed game for Avengers Infinity War.
Yeah, Thanos loved it.
Yeah, so Thanos Rising, the system was already something he'd been working on and then quickly developed to fit that theme really well. And then based on the success of that and the depth of IP we have access to, we decided to do a few more versions. So we did Star Wars, we've done Avatar The Last Airbender, SpongeBob, Harry Potter, Batman Who Laughs, and Thanos Rising. So that's the set so far. We occasionally talk about diving back into it and doing some new ones, but Avatar is the most recent.
That one I haven't played, but I really want to. I used to work at GPI, so we did the printing of quite a few of those. So huge fan even before I started working there.
Nice.
Yeah. So let's switch over to designing for IPs, specifically Cuphead. How did you get the IP? What made you the person to work on it? Tell me more.
Yeah, so in terms of getting IP, back in the previous line planning setup that we had, we have a senior VP for licensing on staff. She's been with the company for over 20 years now, is just absolutely stellar at what she does. And what I always appreciate is if there's an IP we want to work with, I can go to Maggie and say, Maggie, I want X, Y, or Z thing. And if she doesn't know who to call immediately, she knows who to call to find out who the right contact is. So generally for things, you know, Disney, WB, the major studios, we already have those connections established. But something like Cuphead that's more indie takes a little bit more doing and figuring out, okay, it's Studio MDHR. How do we reach out to them? What's the proper communication channel? But our team does attend Licensing Expo every year. So there's a lot of scouting that happens at that event to see what IPs are popular, what IPs are available, and things of that nature. So Cuphead was one that kind of came up in the line planning discussions as, you know, at the time it was super hot. It was getting a lot of recognition in the video game space for being so innovative, for having this incredible artwork style that was done in a traditional format and really being like a trendsetter in the video game space. So it obviously got our attention based on that popularity as something we might want to do a tabletop game for. And so through our licensing team, we were able to reach out and forge that connection to sort of say, would you be interested in having a tabletop game? And they pretty quickly said yes. The challenge was more figuring out what the right game was for that. You know, in terms of how I came to work on it, I had an interest in the game and in the IP and creating something. And generally, you know, we have a team of developers in-house. And when we were doing a ton of IP product, there would sort of be a distribution like, okay, these are the games we're going to make. Who's going to do what? At least when I was game design manager, there'd be a little bit of, okay, you love this IP. So obviously you get that. But because you get that, like what thing that no one wants are you going to take, you know, that or that no one knows? So, you know, there's years where like I got to work on Avatar because I love Avatar. And then I made JoJo Siwa Monopoly because someone had to make it. And no one on our team was already a JoJo Siwa fan. So we sort of had to figure that piece out.
I feel like Cuphead for me was like such a chaotic element of these like 1930s art style. Feels kind of like the old Mickey Mouse drawings just like popping around like crazy. Like there was so much to look at. So I'm interested to see like what were your initial ideas for the IP to kind of translate that experience into board game mode?
Yeah, so one of the things that's tricky with video games is you're trying to create a board game that appeals to that audience, but you can't recreate the video game, right? So, you know, you look at some of like the first-person shooter type of games that have had tabletop iterations, and you go from this like instant sign-on, huge group of people playing, real-time chaos to 2-3 hour complex setup. Ugh. Dudes on a map.
No offense. Not for me.
Right. It's not my preferred style of gaming either, but I think the pitfall there is like sort of the experience is what you want to recreate, not the exact gameplay. So by trying to recreate that first person shooter experience, you end up with a sort of slow, tactical, turn-based thing rather than the real-time stress energy piece. And so with Cuphead, I mean, obviously part of the research is playing the game, and I'm terrible at the video game. It's very hard, as many people may know. You know, so my initial goal was, well, I'm going to play the whole game, right? And I'm going to learn every level and do the thing. And there got to be a point where I wasn't good enough to get through as much of it as quickly as I needed to. And so that led me to watching a ton of YouTube content of streamers basically playing Cuphead and going not only for the win, but for the perfects, you know, and the extreme like success on every given level in the game, and really dialing into what was their experience in playing it. What were they like excited about? And a lot of it was figuring out the right combination of tools, you know, like which weapons do you equip? How do you approach a particular boss? What's the strategy? And then the rage quitting was a big part of it too. It's like, but what we started to notice as we were watching these videos is it was always just on the verge of rage quit. Like the player would get super angry, basically throw their controller and then play one more time. And so as we were thinking about the board game, we were trying to figure out, can we create that experience with a group of players around the table as like a cooperative thing where they're all in that frustration zone, but not at the breaking point. Like it's stressful, it's hard, but you're always close enough that you play again. And eventually you get the win and you go on to the next level and that kind of a thing. So we wanted to kind of bring that experience element into it without necessarily trying to create like the exact side-scrolling map type of vision, you know, shooting at a boss. Like we were okay abstracting that, but what we wanted was like that frantic, difficult, but close enough that you feel like it's attainable kind of stress. So that was really where the focus was in the design.
I feel like how you decided to go real time with it was a good choice to kind of capture the chaotic feel that you have in the video game. Like, how did you decide on which mechanics to use? And also describe how to play the game while we're at it.
The decision of mechanics was kind of a back and forth, because initially the Cuphead team wanted something very different. When we started the project, what they had sort of proposed was, because of the art style that Cuphead has, which is that 30s classic animation style, they wanted a game that felt like it was made in the 30s, lost in your grandparents' attic, and then discovered. And so they kind of wanted that to be the feel of the game. And they actually proposed two games to us initially, two concepts, one of which was essentially a roll and move and really had that like old game feel to it. And the other was the closest like common game I can think of would be Splendor. It was kind of a card collecting set collection thing with that featured a lot of the art. And we ended up kind of pushing back on both of those because our feeling was the roll and move kind of a thing would be purchased as a collectible, but probably not played, you know? And so it wouldn't have the same appeal for the fan base. Like, you know, not unlike some of the licensed Hasbro games we do, a fair number of those are likely purchased as gifts. And then, you know, as a collectible for the fan of the IP, they own the monopoly. Maybe they play it once, but it's not maybe the game they play over and over again. So we really were trying to push them in that direction of, let's make a great game that people want to keep playing and that appeals to your fan base rather than just a collectible. And we didn't really feel like the set collection thing was quite there either. And for a long time, we didn't know what it was going to be. Kind of a stressful like experience of, you know, where do you start with mechanics? And we hadn't even settled on real time. We were just like, what is Cuphead? How are we going to create this? And I distinctly remember being in my apartment in San Diego at the time and was like getting into bed and was thinking about it, was in that like frustrated point of like, I just don't know what we're going to do. We don't have a lot of time. We have to propose something to the team. And then something just clicked in my mind that was essentially the core mechanic of the game. And I jumped out of bed and like scribbled it down on this like yellow legal pad of like, this is what the game looks like. This is how it's going to play. Brought that into work the next day and started hammering out a prototype, and fortunately it worked out. But the way the game plays, for folks who haven't played it, is it's a real-time dice rolling game. Each of the bosses that you encounter throughout the Cuphead video game is a deck of cards. And so you start with the first boss, you open that deck, and you sort of unlock that content. And then you have a player board, and you're speed rolling dice, everybody at the same time, trying to match symbols on cards from that boss deck. So you deal out three cards from the boss deck. They'll have one or two dice symbols per card, and you have to roll and assign those dice with matching symbols in the order they appear on the cards. And you're trying to do that all in 20 seconds or less, depending on the difficulty level you're playing. And all of the players, up to four players, are doing this at the same time with their own set of dice. And while you're doing that, on cards that only have a single die, you can optionally add a die that has the shoot icon on it to fire back at the boss. But of course, that takes extra time out of your dice rolling. It takes an extra die out of your dice pool. And any card that you don't match from the boss does damage back to you. So all within this very short time frame, you're trying to make these very quick decisions of, well, do I try to get an extra shot here? Do I just play it safe and try not to lose any hit points? Because if any player gets knocked out, then you have to restart the whole level and all the players lose. So you've got these different choices to make. There's optional cards that come out that let you play extra dice to go for power-up cards that can be very useful later. But of course, you have to do more in the current round in order to earn that bonus for later. And as the game unlocks more bosses, new rules are added that add more complexity to the thought process you have to do in that 20-second period, or 15 seconds, or even 10 if you're playing in the super hard mode. So it just kind of ramps the complexity of the mental gymnastics you have to do in that quick time. And so what happens is you get this like really frantic thing of everybody rolling dice, assigning the dice, and then the timer goes off, and then everybody pauses and resolves the dice, and you kind of get your little bit of breathing room. And, you know, some players will take some damage, and then, you know, if you do a couple hits to the boss, and as you progress, you usually get the boss pretty low, and then a player gets knocked out, and you're just on that line where it's like, if you lose, you were so close, you want to jump in and try it again. Or you have that one player that just has to roll perfect because they only have one hit point left, and, you know, everybody's kind of staring at them as they're frantically rolling, hoping they get it. So it created this good group tension and stress, but it also has, because it's only 20 seconds, you have like this relief period where you kind of reset, and then 20 seconds of stress again. So it's kind of an ebb and flow that I think works pretty well for it as well. And there's a bunch of those boss decks in the game. So what you're trying to do is beat each of the bosses, unlock the next one, get through the next one, and so on. And then you'll unlock new power-ups, new special cards, new abilities you can use as well, which kind of mimics the surprises and content you get in the video game. And then it has a scoring system, which you can do either through the app or manually with a pad to kind of rate, like you can beat a boss, but only beat that boss on like a C, or you can beat it with like an A grade by doing really well and having lots of extra hit points left. And that kind of went after that perfectionist Cuphead player who doesn't just want to win, they want to perfect every level of winning and sort of say they're the best at it. And we did see quite a few groups that, even in early playtesting, they'd beat a boss and be like, okay, drop the timer down to the 10 second mode. We want to see if we can do that. And it just kind of kept them engaged in trying to keep playing the game over and over, which is always a win for publishers. Playing a game once and forgetting about it is, you know, while we got the sale, it doesn't keep it front of mind for word of mouth and things like that. When players get a game that they can't put down and they keep playing over and over again, then they're more likely to talk about it, share it, and promote it to their friends. So that's always what we want.
Yeah, I thought it was also really cool that you have a save sheet for those of us who can't complete a full game at one time.
Yeah, there's very few people, I think, who will marathon a game like that. You know, in some ways, the Cuphead system with the deck boxes and the content unlocks is similar to our deck builder, whether it's the Harry Potter version or Toy Story or Avatar, where like you play a session, if you win, you unlock more content, you can keep going. We occasionally see people marathon those, like they'll get a group together for a weekend and they'll plow through all of it. But for the most part, we know that, you know, especially if you have cats or something that might jump on your game table, you can't leave things set out and say like, oh, we'll come back to that in a week. You got to put the game away. And because you're unlocking certain power-ups, you're gaining coins that you can use to buy other things, we needed a clean way for players to sort of jot down, like, this is what I was doing, this is what weapons I had equipped, this is, you know, how much money I had left, and these are the scores I've gotten on all the different levels and how far I've played. I've even seen players like write strategy tips down on there of like, when fighting this boss the next time, try this combination of power-ups to see if that's more effective or more efficient for getting through that level, if that can get me the better letter grade the next time I play it. So it was nice to have that kind of template for folks to use.
And what tends to be the player dynamic as they go in between the like stressful 20 seconds versus not? Are they like pre-planning and going, hey guys, like this is what we should do. All right, set the timer, go. Is that more what happens? Or are they like yelling at each other and spur of the moment during the 20 seconds? Like how did that normally work out?
During the timer mode, there's a lot of sometimes incoherent, sometimes offensive yelling that's happening as, you know, as people are stressed, you know, or a die bounces kind of out of their rolling area and they're chasing after it across the table. And you get people just making noises as they're stressed about trying to get a particular symbol to match a requirement for a card. Or you get the player who just rolls lucky early and they stop and they're like cheering everybody else on or trying to kind of help the other players. Once that 20 seconds stops, it does become more strategic. you have to kind of check your cards and resolve and make sure everybody properly tracked how much damage they did to the boss, how many hit points they were supposed to take. So usually one person will take the lead on that and kind of walk everybody through resolving each of the cards in order to see what happened. And then when the new cards, you know, new cards will come out to create the next challenge for dice rolling, players generally then take a moment to sort of say, okay, what are we going to do? Well, you've got that power up, so there's an opportunity for you to get extra damage. So why don't maybe you go for that? Or, you know, when you get to the end of a boss, if you are able to knock the boss out on the first card out of the run of three cards, you don't have to resolve the other cards because the boss is defeated. So players will often talk about strategy of that. It's like, oh, let's just do all hit points on the first one. Then we don't even have to roll the for the other cards. But if those other cards are opportunities to earn bonuses, then it'll be the opposite of like, nobody do damage on the first card because we have to get to the second card where we can get the reward. And then we'll knock the boss out on the third card. So there's sort of a talking through of that. In the early version of the game, you dealt the cards out and then immediately turned them face down. And players had to memorize what the symbols were. And what we saw in that is people would just chant the symbols in order as a group over and over while rolling the dice. And it was really kind of intimidating, scary mode of like, okay, run, jump, duck, duck, run, run. And they would just kind of chant that over and over to make sure nobody screwed it up. And it often led to mistakes because somebody would get the order wrong and start the chant in the wrong spot or whatever, which was a fun kind of chaos. But we did have a great moment though, where we were playtesting and we knew we were hitting the right stress level dynamic. There's a group of us sitting around a table and the op offices, like the creative department, is a big open area. So you've got marketing, graphic design, game dev, project management are all in this big sort of warehousey open space. And there's like clusters of desks with tables. And we were playing the game at one of the tables. And it was my supervisor at that time and me and a couple other people were playing. Unbeknownst to us, because we were focused on the game, one of the other devs was on the phone at his desk with his insurance company trying to resolve something. And we're playing Cuphead, and there was a fair amount of foul language coming out during the dice rolling, particularly from my supervisor at that time, you know, swearing up a storm. And the insurance company asked the other dev who was on the phone, they're like, they thought he was like in danger.
Oh, no.
Because they heard all this like yelling and swearing. They're like, are you okay? Do you need to get to a safe space? He's like, oh, no, those are my coworkers playing a game. Like, we're fine. And there was sort of the swearing was indicating like this rage was building, like people were getting kind of frustrated. And yet every time I was like, okay, we can stop, the group was like, no, one more time, one more time. We're going to do it again. And so it's like, okay, you're mad, but not really mad.
Oh, I get feisty while playing games. I jokingly fire most of my coworkers during playtests. So like, I understand.
Yeah, we've all been there.
That's so fun. So yeah, you have your 20 seconds or 15 or whatever level you've decided for actually rolling to try to match those symbols that are out. But then afterwards, you have the ability to use those power-up cards or whatever you've collected throughout. Or if, say, someone hits zero on their HP, you can... What is the token called that you can use in order to save someone?
It's called a parry token.
Yeah, it kind of looks like a slap.
Yeah, in the video game, like... If you're playing multiplayer, somebody loses their last hit point, they turn into a ghost. And if you can get over and high-five their ghost before they go off the screen, then you can bring them back. And so we kind of built that in as there's ways you can earn these little high-five parry tokens and then spend them to bring somebody back. But of course, those having those left over at the end of the round is worth extra points that boosts your letter grade. So you really don't want to have to use them, but you do want to collect them just in case. So it's an extra layer of that decision-making. And then in addition to those, you can get cards that if somebody misses a dice symbol, you can give them a card with that symbol on it. And it's like counts as if they rolled it. And then you have weapons that you can equip at the start of each fight that let you do certain unique abilities that might change your decision making or push some players in more of a direction to sort of be the healer versus the damage player versus just the survivalist who's just trying to get through without taking any hits.
And with the dice that each player is getting, they have the white ones and then the black one. Want to talk about the difference between them?
Every player has one black die or EX die or X die, and it has different functions depending on what weapon you have equipped. So it's the basic weapon. If you use that die to do a shoot action to damage the boss, it does two hit points instead of one. It's just another way of adding that extra layer of thinking of, let's say the first symbol you need is a jump. As you're rolling the dice and you roll a jump, but the jump is on that black die. Now you've got a decision. Well, you could just equip it for the jump so that you can keep rolling because you might have four or five other dice symbols you still need to match. And, you know, time is running out. Or you could press your luck and pick it up and re-roll it, hoping to get a jump on a different die so that you can save that special die to do damage later. It's a bunch of those sort of micro decisions that are happening super quickly that present the challenge in the game. And as I mentioned earlier, like each boss will add new rules and new ways you have to use the dice or new levels of that thinking just to kind of mess with the players so that nobody, you might think you've mastered the game after the first boss and then you get to the next one and there's a new surprise and you're like, oh, wait a minute. Now I have to think about another thing while I'm making these decisions.
And typically you have about 3 cards out and then you have a wallop card, right? That can affect things.
Correct. So the wallop is an optional card. If you reveal a wallop card, then you add a 4th card to the sort of tableau that you have to get through. The 3 regular cards you have to assign the dice symbols to avoid taking a hit point. The wallop can be skipped without penalty, but if you roll and match the symbol and assign a die to that card, then you get to draw one of the wallop cards. And the wallop cards are where you get those extra dice symbols that can be used by any player, when you're resolving the dice to basically skip one that you missed. There are cards in that deck that give you the ability to heal players, which used at the right time. Somebody's about to get knocked out. You want to play that card, bring them back to full health if you can. There's some that give health to all the players, different things like that. So another level of thinking there, of course, is if you've got 6 dice in your dice pool, if the 3 other cards that come out need 2 dice each, the only way you're going to get that wallop is if you take a hit point on one of those other cards because you don't have enough dice to do all 4 cards. If you've got sort of, you need 4 or 5 other dice for those other 3 cards, then you've got to decide, well, do I go for the wallop that's optional? Do I go for the shoot action to try to damage the boss and just move us closer to the goal? Do I try to do both? And that's where some of that tactical discussion comes in before you start the timer of like, should we all go for the wallop? Is somebody better poised or positioned to go for those cards and maybe other players do the damage and trying to figure out like what is your best option as a team?
So what happens if 2 players end up getting a wallop card, but there's only the 1 card? Is it just, hey, you get it, I'll do something next time? Or is there some kind of mechanic baked in for situations like that?
So there's actually a deck of wallop cards. I don't know that I've ever seen it run out. The cards in the boss deck will say wallop and then have the symbol you need to roll. And if you do it, you draw from that deck. And so that's, you never quite know what power you're going to get. If you're playing 4 players and all 4 players do it, they would each draw a card and you'd add 4 to your collective pool, which also, if you don't use them, is a big boost to your score at the end of the game. So in order to get like those perfect scores when fighting a boss, you essentially need to get through with no players taking damage, get every wallop card in the deck that you can get every parry token you can get, and not use any of it. So it's really, really hard to do. If you really want to go for a perfect score, you have to do all of that using a 10-second timer, which new players always think is impossible. But I've watched experienced players do it. And one of our early playtesting groups, in fact, almost on their third play, like their third round, dropped to 10 seconds. And they were just absolute pros at the game right out the gate. And we're going at that faster time. And I couldn't even like process what they were rolling at the speed that they were assigning dice. So it was pretty cool to see.
That's how I feel when I watch people do like Dance Dance Revolution on the harder levels. I'm like, how is your brain and your feet doing this?
For some reason, Rock Band drums I could do, but I could never do the guitar.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's just something about that sequence of buttons. Like, I don't know what it is. And it's funny because I play guitar, but I couldn't do it on Rock Band.
Oh, no, it didn't translate over.
No.
Oh, that's so funny. It's also like when I think of this Cuphead game, it just makes me think of like when I used to play Super Smash Brothers with like my best friend Eric, and he's the kind of guy who wants to get like all the stars, where I'm like, no, I just need to like finish the level. I just need to make it there and not die. And so seeing the different types of players, especially when you have different types of players in the same group playing together, I'm sure causes a lot of chaotic fun.
Oh, yeah. And it's there are the perfectionists and then there's the like, I tend to be more of an exploratory gamer. So like I want to get to the next box and see what's in there. Like that's where my excitement comes in. I don't necessarily feel the need to like the achievement gamers want to like check all the boxes, do all the things, do every side quest, get all the loot, whatever it may be. And I think that's why it was so important to do that research, like watching people play, because it, like with any IP you work with, you really have to be in the mindset of the fan base. Like what do they love about it? And seeing like, well, some players just wanted to say they beat the game. Other players wanted to play it over and over again to be the best and maximize and get those achievements. And knowing that like, if I play a story game like Last of Us or something like that, I put it on easy mode. Like I'm in it for the story. I want to play, but I don't want to fight the same group of zombies infected over and over and over again and keep losing. Like I get frustrated with that. Like I want to see what happens next. So kind of move it along. But there's certainly an audience that wants to just put it on insane mode where if you die once, you lose and have to start over. And I'm like, I don't have enough time in my day to start a video game from the beginning again. But we wanted to have those elements for that fan base in the game without requiring them, if that makes sense.
That totally makes sense. And when you were presenting the initial idea for Cuphead, did you actually build out a full prototype? Did you just put together a few slides that you showed in a presentation? Like, how did that process go from presenting it and then showing off the developmental changes as it continue to become a real game?
Yeah, that process works differently depending on the game and the licensor for us. In this case, it was the first time we'd worked with the Cuphead team. The creators were very involved in the decision making. You know, with a larger IP, you're usually working with a licensing team. If you're working on Star Wars, you're not working with George Lucas. You're working with the Star Wars licensing team at Disney. So in this case, because we were working with the creators, we really wanted to create something that had a cool factor right out of the gate. And we knew that what they presented to us as what they thought the game should be was so different from what we were presenting back to them that, you know, the direction we thought it should go. So we really kind of went above and beyond and made a full art, not final art, prototype. So we had access to their assets and some artwork online and things like that that we used. And the design and style of the game was done by one of our art directors, O'Neill Beale. And the sort of prototype art, he made the card frames and stuff, ended up being really close to what we used for the final game because it just worked really well. It had a great vintage style to it. The studio MBHR team really liked it. We kind of went that extra mile to create something that was really highly presentable, but it was just the first boss. And then it was a hint at what the rest of the game would be. So we had the first weapon card and things like that. And then sort of a list of brainstorm ideas of this is what we sort of envisioned the next boss doing and what it changes. This is what we think the next weapons and things you might encounter and get and the next power-ups would be. So it was enough that they could play it and sort of get a teaser of where we were going to go, because we didn't want to go the full build all 8 boxes and finish it and then have them say, we don't want that.
Oh God, yeah, no.
And then we were very lucky that their team was going to be in Toronto for a convention, and Andrew Wolf, who was on our team at the time, was also going to that convention. So he was able to take that prototype with him to the convention and sit down and teach them to play it and play it with them to make sure that they had the experience we were hoping they would have with it, get their feedback and bring it back. And fortunately, they really enjoyed it and saw the vision for what we were trying to create that sort of fit the experience that we thought their fans wanted and gave us the blessing to move forward.
Yeah, I'm sure playtesting this digitally would have been very, very different than the physical form if you even did it.
We had a digital version, but ended up not using it. You just couldn't roll and assign the dice fast enough.
Yeah, that's kind of what I figured.
Yeah, we tried a longer timer. We tried some different things. And I only honestly really remember the digital version because the dice had sound effects just because they could. And it became kind of a running gag of what the sound effects were each time you played because we kept changing it. It was fortunate that the game was designed pre-COVID when we all worked 5 days a week in the office because it needed that kind of attention and testing. Doing a real-time game now with how our model is and a lot of our teams being remote would be a bit more challenging, I think, for us to get dialed in as quickly as we did with Cuphead.
Yeah, I'm sure. So did you all have plans to maybe try a different IP on it? Like I mentioned, I feel like Super Mario Brothers would be very appropriate for this.
Yeah, so we actually did present the game system to the Nintendo team not long after Cuphead came out. It was getting pretty good fan response and reviews from people who like Cuphead. And we just thought Mario would be a great way to introduce this game system to a much larger audience. And the concept that we'd kind of put together was each of the 8 boss decks that you find in Cuphead, we wanted to kind of do, or at least I wanted to do a different era of Super Mario. You know, so box 1 would be the original NES game. Maybe you jump to Mario 3, then Super Mario World, jump over to N64 and, you know, get all the way up to a much more modern Mario Galaxy or something by the end.
That's so interesting because I feel like in my brain, I would have thought more of the different lands that they go to in the Super Mario Brother game. And what was their response?
There was some hesitation, I think, about blending the eras. There's certainly some challenges with the art because when you start looking at player boards that carry over, are they 8-bit, 16-bit, or are they the modern art or whatever? So I think if we'd been able to move forward with the game, we probably would have locked into one era. And in that case, I would have liked to explore Mario 3 because you had those maps. you know, where you could move between the different levels. And I thought it'd be kind of fun to do a system where like you could kind of choose a path a little bit in terms of what you unlocked. And I wanted to bring in that like slot machine thing of Mario 3, you know, where you had those like little bonus houses where you could do that or something unique like that. But ultimately, one of the reasons you don't see a lot of Nintendo IP in the board game space is there's certain guidelines and things you have to follow when working with the IP. Understandably, given the scale and the scope of Mario and the history, they want to be somewhat protective of how that IP is used. So it's pretty challenging to get a game through the approval process. It has to go through both the US team and the Japan team, and they have sort of different standards and things that they look for to give those approvals. Generally, what they like to see is a if they want to partner with a particular system or a game, they like to see it have established history in the market, particularly in Japan. And so the Cuphead game system just didn't have the sort of established reputation and pedigree maybe that they would normally look for before attaching Mario to it. So we just weren't able to get the go-ahead to move forward on it, which is a bummer because I think it would have worked really well for fans. I think it could have been a fun product. But I also know with all the other things they're doing nowadays with movies and Lego and things like that, they've got a lot of considerations for licensed product from the Nintendo brands. And so they get to be a little bit choosy in where they focus their attention. Because of course, anything they approve takes resources on their side too. They have to approve all the artwork. They have to approve the gameplay. They have to be evaluating it and managing contracts and things like that. So understandably, they can't say yes to everyone.
Oh, for sure. It makes sense. And then how long do you think it took from that initial inspiration of jotting it down on a pad to the game coming out?
Generally, with our timelines, it's under a year because what'll happen is, you know, we sort of plan a line. You know, these are all the products we're going to make for a given year. With something that was a signature original game, it's like, okay, we've committed, we're going to make a Cuphead game. It essentially had a release date when we decided we were going to do it, and it would have been in the next calendar year. Might have been just over a year, but it was definitely not significantly more than that. And that's from essentially like concept through playtesting, art development, production to shelf. The tricky things when you work with an IP is you have to have a contract with the IP holder to do the game. And that contract timeline is usually, let's say it's a 3-year deal. You have a minimum guarantee. Your royalties that you pay to them must meet that minimum threshold. And if they don't, you have to pay them the difference. So you're basically saying like, if you let us do this, we will earn you at least this much money in royalties. And then you've got like a 3-year window, and that 3-year window will include the development approvals process to get the game to shelf. So you really need to be pretty efficient in getting through that process to maximize how much time you have for the product to be on shelf within your contract window. And then, you know, as you approach the end of that contract term, 3 years or whatever it is, you have to make a tough decision of, if we renew this contract for another 3 years, can we continue to sell enough of this one product in order to earn against that minimum guarantee? And or is there enough other new product we want to make within this brand to get us there? And that's why you see some of the IP games have a short lifespan on shelf. And then that threshold wasn't quite there to say like, we're confident we're going to do a huge volume of this if we go another 3 years. It can be very cyclical of like, okay, we did our thing. We got it done as quickly as we could. We got it on shelf. We made a good splash with it. We got it out to the fans who really wanted it. And now we're going to go do a new one for a different fan group.
I always found that interesting too, because in the timelines, you also have to think about the approvals that you're going to go through with the IP. And some IPs are really fast and some are so slow. So even though you're ready to go, they might not be.
Yeah. And depending on the IP, a larger established team with a full licensing department has some pretty predictable guidelines of how quickly they can get through different things. An indie studio, which Studio MDHR was at the time, like it's a little bit more unpredictable. They might be super on top of it because they really have the one game and that's all their focus. And maybe they don't have a lot of licensed product coming out. Or it could be that they're so new to it, they sign on a bunch of licensing partners for, you know, t-shirts, keychains, toys, et cetera, and they don't have a licensing team doing those approvals. So the creators are doing that while also trying to do like Cuphead 2 or something. There's a little bit of a gamble, I guess, sometimes with what those timelines might be. We actually, when we build our project timelines, certain IP holders, like we know like what their standards are. And so we can build that into the timeline of like, if we make this game, it takes this long. If we make this game with this IP, we need to add in X number of months. And we can plan for that, and it makes it a little bit more manageable to kind of go into it knowing like there will be some downtime. It's also why we do the volume of product that we do at the op is, you know, especially with that co-brand team, they might have 30 to 40 different projects they're doing in a year. So if one of them is sort of on pause for approvals and review, the graphic design team can be working on another one that just got feedback and making adjustments. So they're kept busy and they're just kind of bouncing between different ones based on what's ready for changes and what's sort of in approvals.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. From the design side, what was your favorite and your least favorite experience of it?
That's a great question. I think probably least favorite part of it was the proofing and getting the actual production game assembled right and making sure we gave everything to the vendor, the factory to do right. Just because, you know, you've got hundreds of cards that need to be printed, cut, and sorted into different deck boxes, and not just sorted, but stacked in a particular order in order for the game to work. And, you know, we had to have all of that information really dialed in and right, while also, of course, proofing the text on the cards and the proofing the text in the rule book and the box bottom copy. And there's just a lot of moving pieces to get the production right and all the pieces and the cards in the right order in the right boxes. That was a little bit stressful. And there was one thing we missed in all of it, which is arguably minor, but still, you know, kind of a pain point, is in the prototype, the Perry tokens, we just used generic resource cubes. And there is one card that says Perry Cube instead of Perry Token. And every few months or so, the question comes up on BGG. It's like, is there a different piece that's a cube I should be looking for? And it's like, no, it's just on all the prototypes, we called them cubes. Yeah, and we missed that one change. I think the most fun part of it for me was the sort of, I often joke, when you design a cooperative game, every time the players lose, the designer wins. And sort of getting to play mastermind behind the scenes and tweaking the difficulty and the challenges of the different bosses, you know, and figuring out, okay, what lever can I pull to make the next one surprising and frustrating, but fun? And then watching different groups react to that and sort of when they were in that borderline rage quit mode, if I was in the room, it would be directed jokingly at me, but it was like, that was just a fun experience to be like, yes, I'm messing with people and making this game hard, but they want to keep playing it. And just having that kind of interaction was a lot of fun.
Oh, cool. And I know, similar to me, you're on a ton of panels giving advice, but what is one piece of advice you give to designers?
Only one.
Only one. You get one. It could be based off IP. If you want to choose like a specific thing, but what do you think?
Yeah, I think no matter what you're designing, whether it's IP or a particular new original game for, you know, whatever theme you want to do, you have to design something you're passionate about. I see designers sometimes trying to design a thing for a particular reason. This is trendy right now, or as a designer, I feel like I need to experiment in this mechanical space because I've never done it before. Or, you know, they create these sort of artificial design challenges of, let me mix these three mechanics together. And it's like, those are good tools. Like if you were in a design class, like in college, I think those would all be great assignments to like flex designer muscles. But when it really comes down to making a game that will be marketable and exist as a product and that people will be excited to play, you've got to go through so much playtesting, development, taking it to conventions, showing it to people over and over. And if you're trying to like do that as an exercise to build a certain design muscle, it becomes a grind that I think is not fun and often leads people to design games that are not fun versus, you know, you're really passionate about some weird mechanism you came up with or some weird theme that you're just like, I just want to explore this. I'm really jazzed up about it. That'll carry you through a lot of the work and become infectious for the players, I think, to get a game across the finish line. So I think that's a lot more important than like setting a challenge and seeing if you can meet it.
I think that's a good point. I know sometimes in the beginning, I definitely did that whole try a different mechanic every week situation. But now it's more, oh, I feel passionate about this theme or this mechanic seems fun. Or like, oh, everyone really enjoys this experience with this other classic game. How do I capture that but make it new?
Yeah, and I think doing it early, like you can do the experimenting and the freeform thing now because you've honed and refined those skills early on, right? But if the design brief you give yourself is, I'm going to mix Press Your Luck and deck building together, then you start getting bogged down in the, like, well, mechanically, how does that work? Versus like, what is the fun experience I want players to have? And why do I want them to have it? And like, that, you know, as you said, like taking a classic game and reimagining it, like I mean, ultimately, Flip 7 is essentially that, right? It's like a little bit of blackjack, press your luck.
Pretty sure it's like that Pairs game that you play with just like a deck of cards.
Yeah, it's quite a bit like Pairs. And you know, it's one of those things that game was rejected by so many publishers, including us at one point. And David Blanchard was championing it from the GPI side for a long time. And when he came to work for us, was like, guys, Flip 7, I've been pushing this thing forever. We should really do something with it. And it's funny how many like established designers you can talk to about a game like that who maybe would never make it because we talk ourselves out of it. It's too simple. It's too similar to something else. You know what I mean? It's similar to other things, but it is just plain fun and approachable. And you know what I mean? And at the end of the day, that's what really matters, is it's fun and people are passionate about it and want to share it with other people. And you end up with a success that way.
Oh, totally. I mean, every time Caution Signs has been up for a party game of the year, Flip 7 is also in the same category for the same thing. So clearly, like, it's doing great. But all right, besides Flip 7, are there any other games from the op or from you personally that you design that fans should be looking out for?
So my most recent design is the Avatar The Last Airbender deck building game. It's based off of the Hogwarts Battle Harry Potter deck builder that we published previously, cooperative sort of campaign style game you play through with unlockable content, a lot like Cuphead in that way, but it's not a real time. It's a deck building game. And I'm a huge Avatar The Last Airbender fan. So that was like a love letter for me to the creators of like, let me play in your world and to the fans, you know, so it was great to make that. If you're a fan of the series, I highly recommend it. I tried to get every Easter egg in there I could. That is actually the last game I designed since becoming director of hobby. My focus has been product development. I haven't really had time for original design work. But in terms of stuff coming up from the op, we just released a new card game called Tacta, T-A-C-T-A, sort of in the vein of Flip 7. It's not a press your luck, though. It's a little bit more strategic card placement, kind of dominoes-y element almost to it. It's really fun, from Jason Tremblay. And then coming up very soon, finishing production, getting on the water, our next two big hobby games, which are Fountains. And Fountains is, I think, one of the best hobby games we've ever made. Tile placement game where you're building fountains by placing and stacking really uniquely shaped tiles. And it has this really interactive drafting system that allows you to block and activate scoring throughout the game for all the players. So you can kind of manipulate things just that score for you to happen and block things that score better for other players from happening. That adds to a lot of your decision-making around which tiles you take. So that'll be out in August, as well as Tea Witches, which is designed by Manny Vega with art from Sindara Tang. So it'll have a bit of a Flamecraft look to it. It's a little bit heavier game, but you get to play as witches who run tea huts, brewing all kinds of fancy teas for other witches in a magical fictional city. Great mix of just a little bit of press your luck and a lot of worker placement. Very strategic, puzzly kind of game. And super excited about that. It's been on a lot of most anticipated lists for this year. Was originally going to be a Gen Con release, but with tariffs and things, we'll be a little bit behind, but it should be out mid-August as well. So pretty exciting Q3 coming up for hobby.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've been super pumped for the hobby games. And funny enough, Tacta was one of the games that I reviewed for Wacky Wizard. So it's funny to see that I'm now meeting the same designers you guys do when taking on inventor relation roles in my job.
Yeah, it's definitely more and more something I see, and I'm sure you do too, where, you know, there's certain games, whether it's, you know, like a French partner maybe presents us something and we decide it's not right for us to localize in the States, but the next major convention we'll see it from another publisher and it's like, oh yeah, no, that makes sense. Like, somebody should bring that to the States. It just wasn't the right fit for us or whatever. Or Venture will pitch us a game that we feel isn't right, and then someone else does it. And then there's always that like bit of anxiousness of, I passed on that. Please don't let it be a major hit for that other publisher, you know, right?
Yeah, I remember showing you guys Caution Signs and then it ended up being good. And Tony's like, I mean, we had telestrations, so we didn't want to do it. And now everyone's like, damn it. Because a lot of people already had their drawing game and they passed on it for that reason.
That's always the question too, is like, if it became a hit, how much of it becoming a hit was it was with the right publisher who did the right art, the right marketing? The example I always have to give is we passed on Boop from Scott Brady. He brought it to us after we did Hues and Cues, and it was called Gekatai, and it was a very abstract, like glass beads on a grid type of game. And he was kind of toying with the idea of some kind of cat theme, but it wasn't all the way there yet. And I was like, I don't think we could do an abstract. I don't think this will be right for us. And sure enough, Smirk and Dagger did the cats. They did the little quilt, you know, and it's been a huge success for them, and happy to see that for Kurt. You know, we kind of had that debate like, oh man, did we miss out? But then the other side of it is like, well, if we had done it, would we have done it the way he did it? And would it have been the same success? It's hard to know. So it's sort of like, well, maybe bypassing what we did was let that inventor put the game in the right home to be successful.
That's what Nick Bentley said when he worked at North Star Games. He passed up on Wingspan, but it's also like, was it going to be the same game at North Star as it was with Stonemaier? I doubt it. I find it very unlikely the game would have been as big of a success, but it's always cool to see that. But regardless, it's great that a lot of these games are finding homes and coming out so we can all enjoy them. I know Glyphix, I'm glad that you guys ended up taking that one on and are going to be reprinting it because I enjoyed working on it years ago.
Yeah, the new box top that our Party Family game did for it, the team put together, it actually has the plastic pieces embedded in the box top. So they're not ones you can use in the game. They're glued in place. They stick out. So you have like this texture of the plastic pieces that you actually get inside the box. It just gave it a really nice shelf presence. We just got some samples of it. That has a window in the back so you can see the pieces in the box. So I think little touches like that hopefully will help elevate it as a product because it is a really fun game. It just needs more awareness so people can play it.
Oh, totally. Well, I'm glad I found a second home because I was a big fan of it. All right. Well, as my last question, unrelated to everything we've talked about, if you could have designed a game that you're not currently the designer on, like you made a wish and now the genie said, hey, you made Monopoly, what game would it be?
I was thinking about this question because it's a tough one, right? Is that, you know, there's the money aspect of like, oh, I want the one where I would have made enough money to retire. But then there's the like, oh, I love this game and wish I could be working on the expansions and the additional content and things for it. So I'm not sure which way I should lean on this, but you know, certainly money-wise, if I designed Flip 7, I'd be pretty happy right now. But I wouldn't want to take that away from Eric Olson. I'm gonna go with Heat Pedal to the Metal. I love Heat Pedal to the Metal. It's one of my all-time favorite games. And I don't even know that I would envision this that the other designers weren't there and it was just me. It would have been great to be part of that team because Asger and Daniel, who designed the game, are great guys. I think they created a genius system with that game and the way that you have to manage your cards and press your luck. It just feels like a great racing game to me. And what I love about it is they created a system similar to Ticket to Ride in the sense that there is a very long runway for expansion content. And they've already been doing that with new racetracks and new cards and new rules and things. And I just think it'd be really fun to have like an evergreen product like that established that could, you know, you can always kind of go back to as like your hit and keep exploring and mining the depth and having enough fan base to support that game that you could sort of have that in your repertoire forever. I think that'd be a really nice feather in the cap to have as a designer.
Oh, I think that's an awesome answer. I think it's really difficult to create a good racing game that actually feels like you're potentially racing, and that one did a good job. Big fan. I've also played on a custom mat that someone's made before for like a specific convention. They got permission to make it and just print out like, I don't know, 10 mats that they gave away as prizes. So it's just kind of cool that they were able to do that.
Yeah, there's some good ones like neoprene mat racetracks and stuff on Etsy and places you can find around. So the designers of the game are two of the three owners of Sidekick Games, and we do localization for games that they publish under that brand. So we know them pretty well. And I've talked to them as well as the head of Days of Wonder about some of that. And it seems like they're pretty okay with it. You know, it was like, oh, it's supporting the fan base, whatever. But one of the things they pointed out is like they have a whole knowledge base algorithm-y type of system for how the tracks have to be designed to create the right balance in the game. You know, you can't have straightaways that go on too long. You can't have too many turns in a row, twists and turns and things like that. And they said that's why they actually haven't tried to recreate real racetracks the way that fans now are trying to recreate real racetracks, because gameplay first, track design second. And I think they're letting the fans go, I don't care about the balance. I want to brace my favorite racetrack. So it's kind of cool.
No, that is cool. I know the one that I played that was a custom one, we didn't realize shouldn't be set at like, oh my God, I think it was like the highest player count you could do. And they're like, yeah, this should not have been played with more than four people because there was a lot of areas where long one spots and it just got really clunky and awkward and took longer than it should have. Well, Pat, I really appreciate you being on this episode of Game Design Unboxed, episode 118, Cuphead. For anyone trying to find you personally, where can you be reached online? Also, if you want to plug The Op, feel free.
Yeah, so you can find The Op at theop.games. You can find me on TikTok, Instagram. My username is at Dr. Pat Makes Games. I'm a little behind on making content, but I was sharing some game design tips and tricks on TikTok. I'm going to get back to making more content soon there. And certainly at most major conventions, you can find myself or other op staff for game pitches and things like that as well. So That's usually the best way to go about it.
And I've been your host, Danielle Reynolds. Trying to find me on social media, check out my Instagram, X Blue Sky, under the name Token Gamer, spelled G-A-Y-M-E-R. I also have myself on BGG or dmrcreativegroup.com if you want to find any of my designs that I've done. And I'm sure you can find Pat Marino on BGG as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Sweet. Thanks for being on the show. This was fun.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, inspiration to publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out nodirectionpodcasts.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out All Play at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.